Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the Saturday, December 18th, 2021 reading of the Denver Post. My name is Doug Crane. Today we will be reading from the following main articles. Colorado Economy. Income Divide Gets Worse by Alex Burness. Worker Vaccines. Court Lets Mandate Take Effect by Jeff Mulvihill and Andrew DeMillo. In Tight Times, Denver's Thrift Store Santa Offers Comfort, Hope, and Deals by John Wenzel. Volunteers of America, Developer, Partner to Grow Both of Their Footprints by Judith Kohler. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Colorado Economy, Income Divide Gets Worse. Analysis Says High Earners Do Well as Others Lag by Alex Burness, The Denver Post. Coloradans at higher income levels increasingly are more likely than poorer people to be employed and to be enjoying salary growth, according to new economic data and analysis presented to state lawmakers Friday morning. Furthermore, the analysis suggests no imminent end to the widening of the gap between the state's haves and have-nots. I think there was some hope that this would be getting better as the overall macro environment improved, that there'd be a catch-up in the low-income part, State Senator Chris Hansen, a Denver Democrat and Joint Budget Committee member, said at Friday's hearing. It's getting worse, not better. Colorado's economic outlook is optimistic overall, although analysts stressed repeatedly that the Omicron variant of COVID-19 contributes to ongoing uncertainty. The Taxpayers' Bill of Rights requires the state to refund taxpayers in strong economic years, and in a sign of how relatively the state is doing now, analysts are now projecting close to $2 billion in total refunds in each of the next three fiscal years. Each of those totals would be by far the highest in the state since at least 2001. Uneven recovery. But although Colorado has more than bounced back from a recession that set in early in the pandemic, at no point has the recovery been even. After a brief dip in spring 2020, employment for people making at least $60,000 got back to approximately pre-pandemic levels by summer 2020, and legislative analysts now report that employment at this income level is up 9% over pre-pandemic levels. By contrast, people at the middle and lower tiers have never gotten back to normal. Numbers presented Friday show employment for Coloradans making $27,000 a year or less, down 30% compared with before the pandemic. Employment at that tier is in fact falling, a sign that the rollback of federal unemployment benefits has not encouraged low-income workers to get back to work in numbers as great as many officials hoped or expected. The governor's office also reported Friday that wages are up for professional and technical services, which generally offer the highest pay of any category measured by the state. People working in those sectors are closing in on $30 billion in combined earnings per fiscal quarter, up from $25 billion in early 2019. Meanwhile, wages and salaries are either close to or below pre-pandemic levels in other sectors that tend to pay less. Arts, entertainment, recreation, accommodation and food service, retail, healthcare, and social assistance. The top earners seem to be seeing significant increases in wages, but the rest of the employment categories seem to be pretty steady, Hansen said. He asked the governor's office, "Do you see factors in your forecast, in your analysis, that would tend to close that gap, or are we on a new trajectory here where that wage gap is going to continue to grow over time?" Respondent Meredith Moon, Deputy Budgeting Director for Governor Jared Polis, those sectors are going to lag. I don't think we anticipate a huge uptick in wages and salaries in those sectors. Record profits. It's not as though the employers of low and middle income people don't have any money to spare. Data presented by the governor's office showed corporate profits reached record levels this year. In a statement, Polis celebrated Friday's economic forecast, particularly the fact that unemployment, which remains above the national average, has dipped in Colorado for a fifth straight month. Colorado is hiring, he said. Every day, more Coloradans are joining innovative companies, starting new careers, or growing small businesses. As we head into 2022, I will work hard to save Colorado families and individuals money on fees and other costs. Worker vaccines. Court lets mandate take effect. By Jeff Mulvihill and Andrew DeMillo, The Associated Press. A federal appeals court panel on Friday allowed President Joe Biden's COVID-19 vaccine mandate for larger private employers to move ahead, reversing a previous decision on a requirement that could affect some 84 million U.S. workers. The 2-1 decision by a panel of the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati overrules a decision by a federal judge in a separate court that had paused the mandate nationwide. The mandate from the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, was to take effect January 4th. With Friday's ruling, it's not clear when the requirement might be put in place, but the White House said in a statement that it will protect workers. Especially as the U.S. faces the highly transmissible Omicron variant, it's critical we move forward with vaccination requirements and protections for workers with the urgency needed in this moment. Republican state attorneys general and conservative groups said they would appeal Friday's decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. 27 Republican-led states joined with conservative groups, business associations, and some individual businesses to push back against the requirement as soon as OSHA published the rules in early November. They argued the agency was not authorized to make the emergency rule, in part because the coronavirus is a general health risk and not one faced only by employees at work. The panel's majority disagreed. Given OSHA's clear and exercised authority to regulate viruses, OSHA necessarily has the authority to regulate infectious diseases that are not unique to the workplace. Judge Julia Smith Gibbons, who was nominated to the court by former President George W. Bush, a Republican, wrote in her majority opinion, "Vaccination and medical examinations are both tools that OSHA historically employed to contain illness in the workplace," she wrote. Gibbons noted that the agency's authority extends beyond just regulating hard hats and safety goggles. She said the vaccine requirement is not a novel expansion of OSHA's power. It is an existing application of authority to a novel and dangerous worldwide pandemic. She was joined in the majority decision by Judge Jane Brandstetter Strange, an appointee of former President Barack Obama, a Democrat. The case was consolidated in the Sixth Circuit, which is dominated by Republican-appointed judges. This week, the circuit's active judges rejected a move to have the entire panel consider the case on an 8-8 vote. The dissent in Friday's ruling came from Judge Joan Larson, an appointee of former President Donald Trump, who said Congress did not authorize OSHA to make this sort of rule and that it did not qualify as a necessity to use the emergency procedures the agency followed to put it in place. Larson also argued that vaccinated workers do not face grave danger from working with those who are not vaccinated. Arkansas Attorney General Leslie Rutledge, a Republican, said she would ask the U.S. Supreme Court to block the order. At least two conservative advocacy groups said they already appealed to the nation's highest court. The Sixth Circuit's decision is extremely disappointing for Arkansans because it will force them to get the shot or lose their jobs, Rutledge said. South Carolina Attorney General Alan Wilson, who also is chairman of the Republican Attorneys General Association, said in a Twitter message Friday that he was confident the mandate could be stopped. The vaccine requirement would apply to companies with 100 or more employees and would cover about 84 million workers in the U.S. Employees who are not fully vaccinated would have to wear face masks and be subject to weekly COVID-19 tests. There would be exceptions, including for those who work outdoors or only at home. The administration has estimated that the rule would save 6,500 lives and prevent 250,000 hospitalizations over 6 months. On Friday, the U.S. Department of Labor, which includes OSHA, said the Sixth Circuit's ruling will allow the agency to implement common-sense, science-based measures to keep workers safe and healthy during a deadly pandemic. The vaccine rule for private employers is separate from other vaccine mandates announced by the Biden administration that apply to federal government contractors and workers in healthcare facilities that receive funding from Medicaid or Medicare. Those rules also are under assault from conservatives and have been paused in at least some parts of the country. In tight times, Denver's Thrift Store Santa offers comfort, hope, and deals. By John Wenzel, The Denver Post. Things are different for Santa these days. The jolly old elf, for the most part, cannot allow children to sit on his lap, instead opting for nearby chairs. Masks are mandatory to be pulled down only for photos, and the Christmas lists are, to say the least, different. It's been a lot simpler the last couple years, said Jim White, 70, who's played Santa at charity nonprofit events and thrift stores for the past four decades. It used to be, I need a phone or the latest video game console. Now it's just smaller things. Anything will be fine. The kids who White tends to see, such as at a Boys and Girls Club of Metro Denver event at Empower Field at Mile High on Tuesday night, are thrilled when he hands them a $5 toy voucher for ARC thrift stores. The fact that their parents already are shopping there for the holidays shows White, who recently retired from a long career of service at Volunteers of America, that they could use the extra help. White will appear as Santa from 10 a.m. to noon Saturday at the ARC Thrift Store in Central Park Shopping Center, 7485 East Iliff Avenue. That follows appearances in recent weeks in Brighton, Lakewood, and elsewhere, where kids could visit, stop for a distanced picture with Santa, and generally let out some of their frustrations from the past year. One in five Americans will shop at a thrift store during a given year, about the same number who will shop at a major department store, according to a study commissioned by the online resale platform ThredUp and reported by CommunityNews.org. Supply chain issues, high shipping costs, staff shortages, and spiking prices are also rampant on and offline this season. But thrift store shoppers can save 50 to 80% on the cost of the same item if purchased new from a department store, according to a USA Today column. Customers who shop at ARC are also supporting programs that give work opportunities to people with disabilities and other nonprofit programs. The need is constant. Over the years, you hear some heartbreaking stories from kids, White said. The only thing they want, for example, is for mom and dad not to fight. Stop and think about that. White started out working in the Meals on Wheels program for homebound seniors and has since come to co-chair charity events while spreading the message of volunteerism and community service. He's well known in town as an advocate for the city's most vulnerable, handing out Christmas baskets and running toy drives for needy families. But he doesn't want any of this to be about him. It's a make-or-break season for a lot of charities and the families they serve, said White, who last year showed up outside kids' houses in his neighborhood to surprise them, social distancing style. This year, he's made about a dozen in-person appearances. But I'd love doing it. You've got these families standing in line for Christmas baskets. How could you not want to be there? Sometimes the kids ask for puppies or kitties, and as Santa, I'm always telling them I'll do the best that I can. Denver. Volunteers of America, developer, partner to grow both of their footprints in Rhino. By Judith Kohler, The Denver Post. Volunteers of America, Colorado, and the Edens Real Estate Firm have formed a partnership to expand the nonprofit organization's services and expand the developer's footprint in the River North Art District. Edens will acquire most of the property VOA owns in the block between Larimer and Lawrence Streets and 26th and 27th Avenues. The Human Services Organization will hold on to the spot where its headquarters sits at the east corner of Larimer Street and 27th and move its kitchen and food warehouse to a larger building in Commerce City. The real estate firm, which has properties across the country, has acquired Joe's Liquor Store, the one spot on the block VOA didn't own. VOA has been on Larimer in one form or fashion for over 125 years. We plan on staying for the next 125 years, said David Shunk, VOA president and CEO. However, as the Five Points neighborhood has transformed from an industrial area to an art district and entertainment hotspot, Shunk said the logistics of taking in large volumes of food and delivering the 750,000 meals it prepares annually at the site had become more difficult. When he joined VOA about 3 years ago, Shunk said the organization was looking at the feasibility of continuing the kitchen operations in Rhino. Even at that point, due to the growth of our services, we found we were tight on space. The big semi-trucks have a really difficult time loading and unloading in the Rhino area, he added. The organization began talking to Edens in 2018 and 2019 about its property, but wasn't in a hurry to move forward with any deals. Then I got a call during a board meeting that a semi had actually missed its turn and basically run into our building. It had almost taken the side of a wall to the food warehouse, Shunk said. That was sort of our signal that said, you know what, this is not working. It's time to look at some options. After more than 2 years of discussions, VOA and Edens came up with a plan to keep the organization's headquarters on Larimer Street and move the kitchen and food warehouse to a 54,000-square-foot building in Commerce City. The current space is 30,000 square feet. Edens is acquiring the new warehouse and helping to refurbish it. The real estate firm will help renovate the basement and second and third floors in VOA's headquarters, where its administrative, marketing, and other offices will stay. A mix of retail shops and a heritage museum devoted to the history of the VOA will be on the first floor. Shunk and Tom Kyler, managing director of the West Region for Edens, declined to disclose the agreement's financial terms. Kyler said VOA eventually will be the owner of the Commerce City facility. Edens will take over the block VOA owns and develop a mix of uses, retail, residential, and perhaps office spaces. We are working through all the designing and permitting, Kyler said. Volunteers of America Colorado will own their components, and then we will end up owning ours. The plan is to start the move of VOA's kitchen and food warehouse next spring or summer and begin renovating their headquarters in early 2023. Once we get their pieces set, then we'll come in and do the actual mixed-use development. That will span through a 2024-2025 kind of time frame, Kyler said. VOA's mission and what they're doing for the state and for the city, that's the priority. Edens owns the majority of the block across the street to the west of the VOA buildings. The businesses in the area include Denver Central Market, a food hall and marketplace, and Patagonia on Walnut Street. The company owns 16 buildings that house 41 businesses in Rhino. Kyler said Edens plans to include some open space in the Larimer block, underground parking, and housing on the higher floors. The firm is also looking at such businesses as a small food store. There are no pet stores in the area. There are no hardware stores. Those used to be there, but they all kind of left, Kyler said. This block gives us an opportunity to bring in those uses. Although Kyler said he doesn't envision adding a park, he wants to create a chain of green spaces. Edens is involved with an effort to create more green spaces in Rhino and Five Points. The project is being spearheaded by Jevon Taylor, CEO of False Ego, an apparel company with a store on Walnut Street. Shunk said relocating the kitchen and food warehouse, what VOA calls City Harvest Food Bank, will help expand its services at a time when need has increased, boosting operations by 20%. The organization plans to offer more community programs on preparing nutritious meals on a budget and provide space for people who want to start their own businesses, such as food trucks. The VOA kitchen prepares an average 3,000 meals daily for Meals on Wheels, which serves homebound older people. The organization's 12 affordable housing sites will stay in the downtown area. Shunk said people have asked him whether VOA's move is part of the gentrification of Rhino. He tells them the relocation has been in the works for a while and is a win-win for VOA and Edens. "We were outgrowing our space, and Rhino itself was growing," Shunk said. "COVID comes along and just exacerbates the whole thing exponentially. It was a strategic objective for us to be able to grow our nutrition services, our food services to those in need, and this enabled us to do it. We could not have done this on our own." Judge rejects Fox News' request to dismiss Dominion's suit by Katie Robertson and Jonah E. Bromwich, The New York Times. A judge Thursday rejected an attempt by the Rupert Murdoch-owned Fox News Media to dismiss a $1.6 billion defamation lawsuit brought by Dominion Voting Systems over the network's coverage of the company's role in the 2020 presidential election. In the ruling, Judge Eric M. Davis of the Superior Court of Delaware, where Fox is incorporated, wrote that he had denied Fox News Media's motion to dismiss the lawsuit because it was reasonably conceivable that Dominion has a claim for defamation. Dominion, a Denver election technology company, sued Fox News Media in March, accusing it of advancing lies that devastated its reputation and business. More than two dozen states, including several carried by former President Donald Trump, made use of Dominion in last year's election. Along with another vote tabulating company, Smartmatic, Dominion was at the center of a baseless pro-Trump conspiracy theory about rigged voting machines that gave the election to President Joe Biden. The false claims were promoted by the president and his advisors who appeared on Fox News Channel and Fox Business Network. In May, Fox filed a motion to dismiss the lawsuit, arguing that Dominion's lawsuit threatened the news media's First Amendment right to chronicle and assess newsworthy claims. In his ruling, Davis wrote that the company either knew its statements about Dominion's role in election fraud were false, or that it had a high degree of awareness that the statements were false. A Dominion spokeswoman said, "We are pleased to see this process moving forward to hold Fox accountable." Davis also noted that Dominion had objected in writing to Fox's coverage, seemingly to no avail. "The allegations made by Dominion in its complaint," he wrote, "support the reasonable inference that Fox intended to keep Dominion's side of the story out of the narrative." Russia lays out demands for NATO security deal by Andrew E. Kramer and Stephen Erlinger, The New York Times. Kyiv, Ukraine. Russia demanded Friday that the United States and its allies halt all military activity in Eastern Europe and Central Asia in a sweeping proposal that would establish a Cold War-like security arrangement, posing a challenge to diplomatic efforts to defuse Russia's growing military threat to Ukraine. The Russian proposal, immediately dismissed by NATO officials, came in the form of a draft treaty suggesting NATO should offer written guarantees that it would not expand farther east toward Russia and halt all military activities in the former Soviet republics, a vast swath of now independent states extending from Eastern Europe to Central Asia. The proposals codified a series of demands floated in various forms in recent weeks by Russian officials, including by President Vladimir Putin in a video call with President Joe Biden. They represent in startling clarity goals long sought by Putin, who analysts say is growing increasingly concerned that Ukraine is drifting irretrievably into a Western orbit, posing a grave threat to Russian security. The demands also reinforce the notion that Putin seemed willing to take ever greater risks to force the West to take Russian security concerns seriously and to address historical grievances largely ignored for decades. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister, Sergei Ryabkov, laid out details about the proposal in public for the first time Friday in a video news conference in Moscow, amid a Russian troop buildup near Ukraine's border that Western officials have interpreted as a threat of an invasion. The demands went far beyond the current conflict between Ukrainian government forces and Russia-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine, and most were directed not at Ukraine, which is threatened by the troop buildup, but at the United States and Ukraine's other Western allies. They included a request for a NATO commitment that it would not offer membership to Ukraine specifically, but NATO officials emphasized that NATO countries will not rule out future membership for any Eastern European countries, including Ukraine. The proposal highlighted starkly differing views in the United States and Russia on the military tensions over Ukraine. Russia has insisted that the West has been fomenting the crisis by instilling anti-Russia sentiment in Ukraine and by providing weapons. Ryabkov cast the confrontation in Ukraine as a critical threat to Russia's security. The United States and European allies, in contrast, say Russia provoked the security crisis by recently deploying tens of thousands of troops near Ukraine's border. NATO officials said Friday that Russia's proposals were unacceptable in their demands for veto power over now independent countries. They emphasized their openness to a diplomatic dialogue on Russia's security concerns, but said that any discussion would also include NATO's security concerns about Russian missile deployments, satellite tests, and disinformation efforts. Not supposed to happen in your 20s. Grieving young adults find support sitting around virtual dinner tables. National Network links those who are going through similar experiences. By Elizabeth Hernandez, The Denver Post. Ray Sosa felt the weight of loneliness after losing his mother to COVID-19 in July 2020. The 26-year-old Englewood resident started looking for a community for grief support. He signed up for an online group, but found himself to be the only person younger than 50, the only man, and among others, mourning the loss of their cat or job. Sosa said he didn't want to minimize anyone's pain, but losing his only living parent at 26 felt like a far different experience than losing a job. The grief wasn't the same, Sosa said. I walked away thinking this is a very alienating experience. I didn't think there were people who could relate. Young adulthood can be an especially isolating age to handle such a loss, experts said. The Dinner Party, a national grief network made up of young adults with a Colorado component, targets the issues facing that demographic. I was the first person in my peer group to lose someone in my life, said 25-year-old Aggie Fitch, communications manager for the Dinner Party, whose brother died in a motorcycle accident when she was a senior in high school. People had lost a grandparent they weren't close to or a pet and tried to equate things, and that can really hurt, and your peers just don't really have the words or know how to show up for you the best they can. And what was the most helpful for me was being around others who got it. People in their 20s and 30s can be among the first of their friends to go through a magnificent loss, meaning their typical support group might not know how to be there for them, said Alan Wolfelt, a Northern Colorado-based grief counselor and founder of the Center for Loss and Life Transition. This age group is very much at risk for potential lack of support, Wolfelt said. Their peers are often developmentally experiencing high levels of assumed invulnerability, the epitome of, I'm going to live forever. Loss resources often are allocated toward children experiencing grief, camps or support through school, and typical bereavement groups geared toward older adults, Wolfelt said. Sosa, along with more than 90 Coloradans and thousands nationwide, turned to the Dinner Party, a national organization with local groups providing grief support for people ages 21 to 45 who have lost a significant person in their life. Some Dinner Party participants are paired in groups, virtual dinner parties for the time being because of COVID-19, while others are paired one-on-one with a buddy anywhere across the world with a similar loss experience. A very common dinner party experience is being so excited that someone you're meeting has this sad story of grief just like you, but being sorry there's a club. So it's this thrill and sorrow, Fitch said. Elena Lopez del Carril said she was impressed with the way the dinner party paired her with someone whose grief story so closely paralleled her own. That buddy lives in the United Kingdom, but their stories were similar. Their fathers died weeks apart this summer. The 20-somethings are both the youngest in their families and live at home with their mothers. Lopez del Carril, a 23-year-old Broomfield resident, said having someone to talk with who understands what she's going through has been a source of relief and comfort after her father's death. A lung cancer diagnosis led to a host of other health problems. For example, on my father's birthday on August 11th, none of my closest friends reached out to see how I was doing. Not out of spite, but I think just from never experiencing this themselves in our 20s, she said. However, my grief buddy, knowing how hard it was going to be, did reach out. It's little things like that that make me grateful for the dinner party. Lopez del Carrillo said she talks with her new friend regularly every few weeks, usually for hour-long conversations, and they ping each other during rough days. Thoughts of her dad, an outgoing loud Argentinian with a penchant for snazzy clothes, are constantly at the forefront of her mind. But she worries about burdening others with her grief or talking too much about him. Lopez del Carrillo said she knows her exuberant father, who was always the life of the party, would want her to enjoy her youth, but her grief has changed her deeply. I feel like I'm a middle-aged woman stuck in a 23-year-old body, she said. Right now, it's really exhausting thinking of going out, and my social battery is on low. Grief counselor Wolfelt said society often rushes those grieving to move on or get over it, and that many are uncomfortable and avoid addressing loss. We're a mourning-avoidant, emotion-phobic culture, Wolfelt said. We give people 3 days off work or school, and it better be a biological nuclear family relative who's passed if we're doing that. It's often more important in our culture to get people back to work or school rather than them healing their soul. Laura McCommons, 40, said she barely discussed losing her mom as a teen until she found the dinner party in 2019, shortly after moving from Florida to Colorado and looking for friendship. McCommons was searching online for a group offering get-to-know-you dinner parties with people in your community when she accidentally found the dinner party and realized it scratched an itch she'd been ignoring for decades. I never felt like I had anybody to reach out to who understood what I was going through, McCommons said. The Highlands Ranch resident showed up for her first in-person dinner before the pandemic, worried others would judge her because her loss was years ago. They were so open and welcoming, McCommons said. We all went around and shared our story. I bawled, and it was so weird for me because I thought I should be fine 25 years removed. Everyone else was crying. It was just incredible to be able to share and not feel the judgment society sometimes makes you feel. Oh, you should be over that by now. Since her first meeting, McCommons said she has participated in virtual dinners with her group, been paired with a one-on-one buddy, and met her crew for outdoor picnics so they could stay connected during the pandemic. This is such a great resource, and we formed such great bonds, McCommons said. Wolfelt said time heals all wounds is a misguided phrase because the bereaved must engage in mourning and actively participate in their healing process rather than believe things magically will get better after a certain number of years. Sosa said he is working through his anger about COVID-19 and the loss of both parents at a young age with the help of his dinner party buddy and a mental health professional. This is not supposed to happen in your 20s, Sosa said. The assumption is we're adults now, and we should know how to take care of ourselves. But I'd like to think, if my parents were alive, I'd be asking them questions and utilize them. And I don't have that. I had to grow up really fast. Sosa and his grief buddy usually talk about their daily lives and updates, sometimes not even mentioning their grief. In our conversation, we know the story already, so we don't bring it up, or we know the context, he said. That's what makes these connections really impactful, is there isn't that awkward avoidance. We're in the same place. Principal of Fairview High retires. He spent semester on leave during investigation of lawsuit claims of a hostile environment. By Noel Phillips, The Denver Post. Fairview High School Principal Don Stensrud will retire at the end of the year, months after the Boulder Valley School District launched an investigation into his actions in the wake of a lawsuit filed by two former students who said he failed to protect them from sexual harassment and abuse. Stensrud, who has been on paid administrative leave since August 10th, chose to retire after the investigation concluded, said Randy Barber, a district spokesman. Barber said the results of the investigation would not be made public because of the pending lawsuit. A letter announcing the retirement was sent Thursday night to students and their parents by officials from the Boulder Valley School District. Terry Gillich, who was appointed interim principal when Stensrud was placed on leave, will continue leading Fairview for the remainder of the 2021-2022 school year, the letter said. The district will conduct a national search for a new principal, and district officials will meet with students and parents after the winter break to receive input on what qualities they want in a new principal. Efforts to reach Stensrud and his lawyer, David Beller, were unsuccessful Friday. Stensrud, who worked for the Boulder Valley School District for 22 years, has been under scrutiny for his actions since 2019, when Fairview's former star quarterback Aiden Atkinson was accused of sexually assaulting multiple students. Boulder police investigated Stensrud for obstructing their investigation into the sexual assault allegations after the principal stopped them from interviewing the quarterback. Although police investigated Stensrud, the Boulder County District Attorney declined to file charges. The DA's office sent a letter to Stensrud's lawyer saying the principal's actions harm the criminal investigation, but prosecutors did not believe they could prove he was guilty of obstruction in a criminal trial. Atkinson was acquitted in April of sexual assault and attempted sexual assault in connection with a 2018 incident on a party bus. In May, he pleaded guilty to two counts of misdemeanor harassment as part of a plea deal for other charges that were connected to the case. Stensrud was named as a defendant in a lawsuit brought this year by two women who attended Fairview who claimed that leaders at the high school knew during the 2016-2017 school year that a lacrosse player was accused of raping at least two students but failed to investigate and did not protect students from facing a hostile environment at the school. After the lawsuit was filed, the school district began investigating the accusations against Stensrud. The lawsuit, which also named the district as a defendant, is pending in U.S. District Court in Colorado. The district is changing its policies regarding sexual harassment and assault, as well as training faculty members and other workers about how to handle accusations. It also is improving its support structure for student victims, Barber said. Colorado Board of Education wants to resume state tests. By Yesenia Robles, Chalkbeat, Colorado. The Colorado Board of Education recommended Thursday resuming full statewide testing and using those results to restart accountability ratings, but state lawmakers ultimately will decide what the system looks like next year. The state board weighed in as key Democratic lawmakers are considering legislation that would provide a transition period before schools face the full consequences of low student performance. In a special meeting, the board approved three resolutions recommending that full state testing begin again this spring and that the accountability ratings resume for schools and districts. The resolutions also included details for creating a transitional year in which the ratings would have lower stakes for schools and districts. The legislature will have final say in making these changes this session as they are part of state law. But the board approved the plan to show lawmakers what they support. The accountability system has been on pause during the pandemic. The last ratings were issued in 2019. The 2022 ratings would not automatically move schools or districts on or off the state's watch list for low performance, according to the board's recommendations. Instead, the state board could make policy changes so schools or districts that have improved results that are representative with at least 90% participation rates, could request a hearing with the state to reconsider their ratings. All seven state board members approved the three recommendations. In a written statement responding to the state board's proposed plan, Amy Baca-Olert, president of the Colorado Education Association, pointed out there are still disruptions related to COVID-19 this school year. Today's resolutions made by the Colorado State Board of Education recognize that we are still in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic and all of the disruptions and pressures on students that come along with it, Baca-Olert said. Now, more than ever, we must have a thoughtful transition as we move from the limited and inconsistent data of the past 2 years back to fully implementing the current law. Without a transition, simply resuming the accountability system in 2022 is fraught with issues that will impact the integrity of the accountability system and could cause unnecessary harm to students, schools, and districts. Federal and state law requires standardized tests in Colorado. That's the Colorado Measures of Academic Success, better known as CMAS for students in third through eighth grades, and the PSAT and SAT for high school students. The laws also describe how tests should be used for rating schools and districts. Any changes ultimately require federal waivers and legislative action or an executive order from Governor Jared Polis. State Senator Rachel Zinsinger, who leads the Senate Education Committee, plans to introduce legislation this session that would blunt the full consequences of the state's accountability system while schools are still recovering from the pandemic. The Arvada Democrat said she's still working with colleagues and school district officials to determine the details. It might mean monitoring schools whose performance dropped during the pandemic, but not with the same level of scrutiny, or allowing schools to leave the watch list more quickly. We think there might be some unintended consequences if we just apply the old system. We need an interim approach, Zinsinger said. We can't just step back into the accountability system as if nothing happened. The proposal is likely to face pushback from some Democrats and many Republicans. State Representative Colin Larson, a Littleton Republican who serves on the House Education Committee, said the drop in test scores during the pandemic calls for more attention, not less. At some point, we need to demand accountability again, he said. Our system is not a punitive system. It's an intervention system. The spring 2021 tests were significantly scaled back compared with 2019's as students took either English or math tests, depending on their grade level, instead of both. Participation was significantly lower in many places. Chalkbeat, Colorado Bureau Chief Erica Meltzer contributed to this report. Chalkbeat, Colorado is a nonprofit news organization covering education issues. U.S. General seeks to strengthen South American military ties, by Patty Nieberg, The Associated Press. U.S. Military Southern Command General Laura Richardson is focused on strengthening military relationships with South American countries despite fraught politics, she said a little more than a month after taking on the role. Richardson, the highest-ranking female in the Army, was in Denver to speak at a graduation ceremony at her alma mater, Metropolitan State University. She said that although the politics between the U.S. and South American nations aren't completely what we would want, the military relationships are really strong, Richardson said in a media roundtable Friday. Richardson referenced an example in El Salvador where U.S. political relationships are souring. In November, Jean Manes, the interim charge of the affair in El Salvador, announced she was leaving her post and said the government of President Nayib Bukele is showing no interest in improving the bilateral relationship. Manes's departure was preceded by the Bukele government pulling out of an anti-corruption agreement with the Organization of American States and a refusal to extradite members of the MS-13 gang to the U.S. for trial. This year, the U.S. government also published lists of allegedly corrupt officials in Central America, which include Bukele's chief of staff, Carolina Recinos. Meanwhile, Richardson said the U.S.-El Salvador security partnership remains strong, adding that she recently called Minister of National Defense René Francis Marino Monroy to offer condolences for his son, who died as a pilot in an aircraft accident. The U.S. also sent a helicopter unit from Honduras to aid with search and rescue, she said. Richardson noted that 23 countries went to the Southern Command's October change of command ceremony, where she officially was installed as leader of the agency. That was really tremendous to have that many come and represent because they want to partner with us, she said. They want to do the exercises. They want to work with us as much as possible. Since assuming the position, Richardson traveled to Colombia and Brazil. She recalled her father in her hometown of North Glen asking how far she was and what time zone she was in. I wonder how many other people are like my father and don't realize how close things are, she said, because those are our neighbors. As the new leader of the agency, Richardson said she's thinking about how to maintain relationships with nations large and small so we never leave anybody untouched or feeling like we're not partnering with them. Richardson said the work of Southern Command is increasingly related to humanitarian response related to disasters such as hurricanes or earthquakes. They're also dealing with heightened illicit drug trades, noting that metric tons of cocaine intercepted by the U.S. more than doubled in 2019 and 2020. As a woman who broke through numerous glass ceilings in the military, Richardson said she strives to represent her demographic and make them proud and quipped, "You can get in there and hook and jab with the rest of them." Aspen Hospital's payroll struck in ransomware attack. By Rick Carroll, The Aspen Times. Despite a ransomware attack that disabled a critical function of Aspen Valley Hospital's payroll system, employees will be paid over the holidays and on time, CEO David Ressler said Thursday. Ultimate Kronos Group, a Massachusetts-based provider of payroll services to hospitals, government entities, educational institutions, and large corporations, reported December 11th it had been hacked. In particular, its Kronos private cloud, which Aspen Valley Hospital uses, was exploited by the attack. So far, it's taken an enormous amount of time across the organization on the part of our payroll to manually process 500 or more paychecks, said Ressler, noting the hospital set up an incident command team Wednesday as part of an all-hands-on-deck effort to address a situation that comes when the holidays are just cranking up. "We don't believe that this is coincidental," Ressler said of the timing of the attack. "We think that is part of the cyber attack, to inflict maximum pain just before Christmas. It's horrible and it's purposeful." The bottom line is that AVH workers, however, will not take a hit because of it, said Ressler, who also emailed AVH employees Wednesday with assurances that the status of their paychecks, which are issued every other Friday, was not in jeopardy. "We understand the timing of this malicious attack on Kronos is extremely impactful to AVH and to each of you, if not purposeful, on the part of the perpetrators," the email said. "However, we guarantee you will be paid for your time worked." The hospital uses Kronos to track the hours its employees work, attendance, overtime hours, back pay, day and night shift pay, for instance. "There's an enormous amount of complexity in the information we provide them," Ressler said. "Whether they are full-time, part-time, or on contract, hospital employees punch in and punch out by scanning their badges on Kronos devices throughout the facility, and that information is forwarded to AVH's payroll service, Paylocity, which issues the paychecks. Yet with Kronos down, the onus is now on employees to track their hours manually and to provide them to AVH's payroll department, which will in turn calculate their pay and forward that information to Paylocity," Ressler said. The attack did not compromise the employees' benefits, nor did it exploit any of their personal data, he said. The attack affected about 2,000 businesses and organizations, according to SHRM.org, a human resources website. CDC endorses schools' COVID-19 test-to-stay policies, by the Associated Press. New York, U.S. health officials are endorsing test-to-stay policies that allow close contact of students infected with the coronavirus to remain in classrooms if they test negative. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention decided to more firmly embrace the approach already used by many school districts after research of such policies in the Chicago and Los Angeles areas found COVID-19 infections did not increase when using the approach. "Test to stay is an encouraging public health practice to help keep our children in school," CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky said on Friday. CDC's official guidance for schools has been that when someone in a school tests positive for COVID-19 infection, those who were deemed to be in close contact should stay out of school in home quarantine for 10 days. With the announcement Friday, the CDC is saying both test-to-stay programs and quarantining approaches are equally good options for schools. Hundreds of schools have adopted test-to-stay policies, and several states have funded statewide test-to-stay policies to prevent students from spending long stretches away from school. Previously, the CDC said there is promise in the approach as long as other measures, such as masking for teachers and students, were followed. CDC has been working with some school districts to evaluate the programs, and the agency released two studies that indicated they worked well. One was in suburban Lake County, Illinois, just north of Chicago, which adopted a program in August. Close contacts were allowed to stay in school, provided the infected person and close contact were masked when an exposure might have happened. The close contact had no symptoms, and the close contact was tested 1, 3, 5, and 7 days after exposure to the infected person. Infections developed in only 16 of the more than 1,000 close contacts who were tracked, a transmission rate of about 1.5%. Health officials deemed it a successful approach that allowed many students to stay in school. Similar results were reported in a similar study that looked at what happened this fall in schools in Los Angeles County, California. Researchers counted 7,511 students who were close contacts in school that tried the strategy, and the secondary infection rate was 0.7%. News briefs. Capitol rioter gets toughest sentence yet. Over 5 years. Washington. A Capitol rioter who attacked police officers working to hold back the angry pro-Trump mob January 6th was sentenced Friday to more than 5 years behind bars, the most so far for anyone in the insurrection. Robert Palmer, 54, of Largo, Florida, wept as he told U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan that he recently watched a video of his actions that day and could not believe what he was seeing. "Your Honor, I'm really, really ashamed of what I did," he said through tears. Maxwell declines to testify as defense rests case. New York. After 12 days of testimony over 3 weeks, jurors heard from the final witnesses Friday in the sex trafficking trial of British socialite Ghislaine Maxwell, who told the judge she wouldn't testify because she was confident prosecutors hadn't proven their case. Closing arguments are now set for Monday in the trial, in which Maxwell is accused of helping the wealthy financier Jeffrey Epstein sexually abuse 4 teenage girls. Mayor declares state of emergency to fight nasty streets. San Francisco. The mayor on Friday declared a state of emergency in one of the most crime-ridden and drug-infested parts of the city. That area, the Tenderloin neighborhood, is steps from City Hall, but it has been ground zero for drug dealing, overdose deaths, and homelessness for years. In what many observers said was a sharp turnaround in tone and policy, Mayor London Breed this week said she would pursue an aggressive crackdown on the nasty streets of her city. It is a highly unusual move by a liberal mayor in one of the country's most liberal cities. TikTok posts referencing violence raise anxiety at schools. Columbus, Ohio. Some parents kept their children home, police increased patrols, and educators tightened security protocols Friday in response to viral TikTok posts alluding to unconfirmed threats of violence that raised anxiety levels at schools nationwide. Vicki Cartwright, the interim superintendent of schools in Broward County, Florida, one of the nation's largest school districts, said the U.S. government should take action if TikTok won't get rid of dangerous posts that hurt American schools. Districts said they were taking precautions out of an abundance of caution. Some districts opted to cancel classes for the day or limit where students could go inside school buildings. Many others increased security staffing. More than half a dozen school districts in the Houston area told middle and high school students to leave their backpacks at home on Friday. Crews may have found 1887 time capsule in Lee Statue Base, Richmond, Virginia. Crews working to remove the pedestal where a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee towered for more than a century believe they found a time capsule that was buried there in 1887. The massive bronze equestrian statue of Lee, erected in 1890, was taken down in September, more than a year after Governor Ralph Northam ordered its removal after protests over racism and police brutality erupted across the country after the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. The day after the statue was removed, work crews spent more than 12 hours searching for the time capsule in the 40-foot-tall pedestal, but were unable to locate it. On Friday, Northam announced that crews found the top of a square box embedded in a 2,000-pound granite block. This day in history. In the nation in 2019, the U.S. House impeached President Donald Trump on 2 charges, sending his case to the Senate for trial. The articles of impeachment accused him of abusing the power of the presidency to investigate rival Joe Biden before the 2020 election and obstructing Congress's investigation. The trial would end in acquittal by the Senate. In 1892, Tchaikovsky's ballet, The Nutcracker, premiered in St. Petersburg, Russia. Although now considered a classic, it received a generally negative reception from critics. Thank you for joining us for the Saturday, December 18th, 2021 reading of the Denver Post. My name is Doug Crane.